This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett. And on today's show,
we discuss the hidden benefits of a strong corporate culture.
We've always sort of known intuitively, I think, how important a strong corporate culture is to a business. And when you look at companies that have been really strong, you know, compounders over a multi-decade period, you kind of know that that's got to be something to do with the culture rather than a particular executive or, you know, a particular product.
How investors can actively affect a company's culture.
Essentially, what we're trying to do through engagement is gain further insight on a company's strategy and also seek to influence their behaviour by really helping them recognise the impact of the changing world that they're facing.
And the work they're still to do.
I think if businesses want to build sustainable, scalable futures for themselves commercially, but also to attract the sorts of clients that you're describing there, then they're going to have to revisit a lot of their literature and the way they articulate things so that those messages get through.
From flight shame to gender pay gap and corporate diversity, issues related to sustainability have become part of the everyday investment discussion as investors realise how much it can impact investment performance. And diversity is very much a key theme. Research shows that diversity fosters innovation and improves the bottom line. A 2017 Boston Consulting Group study identified diversity as a key driver of innovation, finding that diverse teams produce 19% more revenue. Actions to improve diversity are afoot. A study by Harvard Business School of US board diversity trends in 2019 found ethnic diversity reached record highs, with approximately 10% of Russell 3000 directors currently belonging to an ethnic minority group, while 15% of new directors are ethnically diverse. While an independent report released this year found the number of women on the boards of directors of Britain's 350 top publicly traded firms has jumped by more than 50% since 2015. While we've come so far, there's still a way to go. So to mark International Women's Day, we speak to Catherine Davidson, a portfolio manager, Head of Sustainability Strategy, Hannah Simons, Gillian Hepburn, Director of Intermediary Solutions, and Stuart Podmore, a behavioural finance expert. We're going to discuss women in finance and what corporate diversity means for investors and how investors as stakeholders can engage with companies and actively force change. But in the first part of the show, we're going to discuss corporate diversity, why it matters, and how fund managers track diversity trends to help inform their investment decisions.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
So, Catherine, we've read a lot in the papers about the way that corporations have restructured over the last few years in terms of how they've set up their boards. Can you just give us a view of what corporate structures look like maybe 10, 20 years ago?
Sure. Well, I mean, given the focus today is Women's Day, then I'm going to focus on the diversity of boards. And in this respect, we have made some pretty good gains in the last 10, 20 years. So, for example, if I'm just looking at the MSCI ACWI, in 2010, there were fewer than 10% women on boards, whereas now it's at 21%, a little higher for the MSCI world, but dragged down by emerging markets. And in terms of women executives, we've also seen improvements there. But I would note that the number of women in the top jobs is still very low. So around 6% in the S&P. And in the number in the FTSE, apparently the number of men named Peter, you know, mentioning no names, was higher than the number of women last year. we're still only at 6 in the FTSE 100, which is not that standout, really.
So it seems like we've got quite a way to go yet.
Yeah, so MSCI estimate that the number of women being added to boards has actually slowed down in the last couple of years. MSCI estimates that it will take us until 2029 to get to 30% women on boards and potentially as long as 2045 to get to the 50% mark. There's also the broader question of ethnic diversity, where I think the discussion is really only just beginning. And the Russell estimate is that we're around 10% today, so that could take even longer. And I think one of the interesting things that we're seeing in the market in the last 6 months in particular is the success of a lot of companies that have very unconventional corporate structures and are much less concerned about even conventional things like board independence, let alone diversities.
Okay, is there anything in particular that's driving these changes? We've obviously mentioned we haven't come quite far enough yet, but what's the main driver behind these changes?
I think there's been a broad-based recognition in the last 5 years in particular that greater diversity at the board and executive level is not just, you know, the right thing to do, but it does actually generate better performance from companies. And it's quite logical when you think about, you know, many organisations, ours included, are serving an increasingly diverse customer base. Women control a lot of purchasing power, a lot of wealth. So having them underrepresented in the strategic, you know, boards and executive groups of businesses just doesn't, it can undermine your ability to serve those customers well. It can also result in groupthink. And I think we saw a lot of discussion about that coming out of the financial crisis, about having different viewpoints, not just from gender, but different backgrounds as well. And I think lastly, there has been an understanding that it can help attract people to your organisation. Having greater diversity of all sorts internally makes it easier to attract and retain staff and builds a healthier corporate culture.
Is there any data suggesting that actually having more diverse boards actually works better for companies?
That's a really good question, David, because a lot of people talk about the benefits of a diverse board or a diverse committee. Investment committees, we hear a lot about that from clients as well. And people sometimes search for the data, but actually behavioral studies are already indicative of what we might do to improve some of that decision making. So Keck and Tang in 2018, for example, put together a study and wrote a paper about the gender composition and of teams, of committees and groups. And they were particularly looking at confidence judgments. And their conclusion from their studies in 2018 said that actually a woman, just one woman added to a small group, reduces overconfidence, for example. I think that's particularly relevant to the investment world and the world that Catherine has been describing so far, because with overconfidence, people tend to overestimate their ability to perform well. They tend to overplace how they perform relative to other people, and they tend to be far too confident in the precision of their own estimates. And just one woman being added to a small group, for example, can reduce that overconfidence and then lead to not just better business decisions, but better investment decisions and outcomes as well.
So, Catherine, as an investor yourself, how do you use that sort of information on corporate culture to find better companies?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I recently wrote about how important corporate culture is, but also how incredibly hard it is to assess. And I think there is a distinction between corporate structure, which we started out talking about, and corporate culture. Corporate structure can give you an indication, perhaps, of the wider corporate culture. So in terms of things like board and executive diversity. But what we do see at some companies is that they've committed to certain sort of levels or, you know, thresholds of women on the board in particular, but that hasn't really filtered down the organisation. So when you especially want to see signs of more women coming in at the bottom in the graduate programmes, better female retention throughout, so more women in middle management, etc., it's not a problem that you can fix just by bringing in external hires at the board level, especially as a lot of, you know, there is a relatively thin pipeline in some instances at the top there. So you end up with some of those women being very overboarded and not necessarily performing to their full potential. But in terms of using corporate culture, I think one of the most interesting things that I do is look at employee job boards. So things like Glassdoor, to see what the comments there are like about the culture and the diversity at the company, whether there are any sort of negative allegations of discrimination, etc. You can look at companies' whistleblower policies, and some of them even report the types of topics that are most frequently raised by whistleblowers. So you can see whether there is potentially a systemic problem at the company, but also how willing they are to sort of tackle that and to share the information. The last thing I would say is that it's great to talk to management teams about culture, and it's possibly not something that is raised very often in a company meeting where you're focusing on financials. But the studies suggest that one of the strongest indicators of a coherent and lasting corporate culture is whether the management team talk about it. Is it something that they can articulate? Do the value statements mean something throughout the organization, or are they just a paper document without having any impact on the actual procedures at the company?
Yeah, I was going to ask, I mean, is there anything more tangible coming out of companies rather than, as you say, just paper documents?
I mean, it's tricky because the general trend across the our industry certainly is to just produce more policies and more papers to try and demonstrate what's happening internally. So I think it's important to look at what companies do as well as what they say. And as I said, things further down the pyramid, like the Glassdoor reviews, and even when you are looking at the documentation. So when you look at a company's value statement, for example, they can be incredibly, anodyne pieces of writing. But the really good examples will give, sort of case studies and examples of what good and bad practice looks like, be very clear about flagging the channels for employees to raise any issues, and also explain why certain values matter to a company and to its success, rather than just sort of being, a nice thing to have on your corporate website.
And just one final question. As an investor, would this be something you might not have even looked at maybe 5 years ago? Is this something relatively new?
I mean, it's not new in terms of its importance, but I think it's new in trying to be systematic in the way that we analyse it. And we've always sort of known intuitively, I think, how important a strong corporate culture is to a business. And when you look at companies that have been really strong compounders over a multi-decade period, you kind of know that that's got to be something to do with the culture rather than a particular executive or a particular product. But I still think it's still very much a work in progress, figuring out how we analyze and assess this. But the wealth of unconventional data that's available to us and the greater awareness of the importance is definitely helping improve the quality of the conversation.
Okay, so that's how corporate karma might affect the way you go about investing in companies, and certainly the way the companies might perform. In the second part of the show, we're going to look at what investors and stakeholders might be able to do in terms of engaging with companies.
Get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website, schroeders.com/investor download.
So, Hannah, we spoke with Catherine in the first part of the show, looking at the way, as an investor, they look at corporate culture and diversity of boards and structures of companies. We can't let Schroeders off the hook. So what does Schroeders mean when they talk about engaging with companies, and what do they do about engaging with companies?
I think it's fair to say that engagement is an integral part of our investment approach here at Schroeders. And it's part of what we call our broader commitment to active ownership. So I thought I'd start out, if I may, by just explaining what we mean by active ownership and then put the spotlight on engagement. So for us, active engagement encompasses three key elements. Firstly, dialogue. That's the everyday conversations we're having with companies. And in fact, Catherine's already been outlining some of how this works earlier in the podcast. But essentially, through that dialogue, we're really trying to understand how companies are prepared really for the changing world that they operate in. Engagement is sort of what comes after this. Essentially, what we're trying to do through engagement is gain further insight on a company's strategy and also seek to influence their behaviour by really helping them recognise the impact of the changing world that they're facing and how they might need to adapt their business practices to be more sustainable in the future. And the final leg of active ownership is voting. And this is a really critical part because it's our ability to use our voice to signal to management where they might need to make improvements if they're falling short.
So in the first section of the show, Catherine mentioned some of the keys to a company's success is the diversity within the company itself. Hannah, have you got any examples of perhaps the way that Schroders has used that to engage with companies?
And thanks, David. Yes, it'd be great to share some of the examples of the engagements that we've been having, and specifically around gender diversity and actually that board diversity. So over the last 5 years, we've actually engaged with over 180 companies globally on diversity issues. And we heard some key data points from Catherine in her introductory comments. So we know that things are sort of heading in the right direction, but there's still plenty of work that we can be doing. And actually, that's one of the ways in which we use our engagement is to really encourage and push companies to be better. So thinking about the work that we've been doing on board diversity, one of the countries where actually progress has perhaps been a little bit slower than we would have liked is the US. And in fact, if we look at the data, in the sort of 8 years from 2012 to 2020, the percentage of female directors that were added to boards actually only increased by just over 3%. So over the past few years, we've written to 40 of our US holdings where they actually had all male boards, asking them essentially to accelerate their progress on transitioning towards a more diverse board structure. And actually what we did as part of that was communicate our intentions that if we didn't see that progress being made or there wasn't insufficient improvements, we'd actually vote again. So think back to those three elements I mentioned earlier of active ownership and that voting piece being critical to that. So what's happened with those 40 companies? Well, today, over 75% of these companies have actually now added women to their boards. I'm not saying that it was just Schroders' engagement that led to that, but I think that's a critical part of the role that we have to play. And clearly, boards do respond when they hear that investor voice. The other thing I'd add is that we updated our own group-wide policy to reflect that minimum requirement we have around female participation on boards. And we set that minimum at 25% in 2018. But as we look forward, I think it's fair to say, so today, obviously, talking about the gender lens with International Women's Day in mind, as we look forward, I think we will look to broaden out, if you like, the focus that we have had in the past few years, which has definitely been through that gender lens. And one area that we'll be looking at in the coming year is certainly ethnic diversity and in particular BAME representation on boards.
What does success look like for Schroders when they engage with the companies? Because not all of these votes on pay, for example, get overturned.
When we think about any of the engagements that we have, David, I think what is critical is really to set out what is our objective and our purpose and the ask of that engagement, because then you absolutely have a metric to immediately assess the success of that engagement or otherwise. I think it's also fair to say, David, that for some engagements, we don't expect that change to happen overnight. We might have quite significant asks of companies, particularly when we think about their setting of their remuneration policy. And so therefore, it might be a 2 to 3 year period over which we expect to see that change happening. And therefore, we're recording and evidencing through that period that change.
And this might be a tricky question to ask, but obviously there are investors within Schroders themselves. So how is that communicated to the investors in the funds if, for instance, you are looking for that change over 2 to 3 years? Is that made absolutely blatantly clear?
Yes, and I mean, we have Catherine today, so she may also want to add to this, but I think it's fair to say that engagement at Schroders has increasingly become a collaborative affair. So I think it was fair to say a number of years ago, engagements were very much led by the sustainable investment team. But today, they are absolutely a collaboration between both the sustainable investment team and our investors. So the first thing we'll be doing when we engage with companies is to actually speak to our investors to highlight and identify what we're engaging on, the purpose and that ask that we've made.
And Catherine, is there any tricky conversations you have to have with investors? Bearing in mind, obviously, not every investor has the same ideology when it comes to things like these.
Oh, that's a dangerous question, David. You're going to get me in trouble. It's certainly true that there are, you know, one of the beauties of Schroders is that there is a diversity of thought internally, and different teams have different investment strategies. But I think there are increasingly a number of red lines that we can all agree on around things like board and executive diversity and general sort of corporate practices. So I think it would be fair to say that there's rarely a dispute on those kind of fundamental issues.
And Hannah, being a part of the sustainable investment team, have the conversations with the fund managers themselves become easier over the years?
So in fact, when we were engaging as early as 2000, it was fair to say that those engagements were largely disclosure based, but also really being led by members of the sustainable investment team. Today, our engagements take place globally. We look for much more focused discussions on driving change. But importantly, those discussions are being led by not only the sustainable investment team, but also our fund managers and analysts around the business.
And do you find more and more that investors in Schroders funds are coming to you to drive these changes rather than it being led by the sustainability team or the fund manager themselves?
I think it is fair to say that, yes. Increasingly, you know, it really is our investors, if you like, if I may say, that actually know these companies incredibly well. And so our investors and our analysts are absolutely well-placed to have these conversations with the companies in which they're investing. The sustainable investment team has supported our investors on their sort of journey by building a proprietary tool where we store all of our engagement activity, but also by helping identify what are some of those material risks that a company faces so that that can actually be the topic of engagement.
Okay, so that's how Schroders goes about engaging with companies trying to drive change. In the final part of the show, we're going to look at what this means for investors. So, Julian, we just discussed how fund managers go about using the corporate karma story and with the way they invest, and how Schroders itself goes about engaging with companies to drive change. What does it mean for the investors? Let's start with why this might be a good story for advisors.
Yeah, great question, David. And, you know, essentially, if we are becoming more diverse as financial services providers and asset managers, then, you know, we better reflect society and therefore the client base of financial advisors. And for me, it's about, I think somebody mentioned earlier, diversity of thought, as well as areas such as gender and ethnicity. So if we understand the clients of advisors, then we can better be in a position to deliver appropriate products and solutions for them. But I think as an industry, we still have a bit of a way to go, don't we? We've only got, I think the latest stats are 11% of fund managers being female, given this is International Women's Day. Interestingly, only 17% of approved people in the FCA are female. And only 28% of financial advisors are actually female. Although the good news there is that this is increasing in the younger age groups of financial advisors. So we're seeing many more women joining the industry and delivering, you know, great quality financial advice.
So those barriers are gradually being broken down?
Yeah, I would say so, definitely. From a female perspective, and if we look at customers, it's really important that women can access advice. By 2025, 60% of the wealth in the UK will be in the hands of women. So we need to make sure that, you know, we're delivering the right advice and the right investment solutions for them. We're also seeing greater numbers of female entrepreneurs, which is great. But on the flip side, we also see that, 40% of women still depend on a partner for, you know, their income and retirement. Although I think the dial is changing on that one. And again, what we're seeing is younger women being much more engaged in their finances and in their savings and investment. And interestingly, according to research, which I always love, 70% of millennial women are taking the lead in financial decisions. So some interesting things there, though. We're doing a lot of research into this area, particularly when we talk about things like wealth transfer. But a statistic that was quite surprising for me recently was we started to look at the requirements for divorced women in terms of financial advice. And if you look at the average pension for a male at the point of divorce, the pension pot is about £106,000. I won't ask you to guess how much that is for a female, but it's £26,000. I mean, that's a significant difference. And this has all got to be about, encouraging women to think about their financial position and how we can help advisors ensure that they can save and invest.
Are there any particular reasons why millennial women are more engaged?
That's a great question. And maybe because, maybe it's because more of them are probably in the workplace, if I could be so bold as to say that. We do a lot of work in terms of wealth transfer. It's been a huge topic in the last few years. For advisors, it's about retaining wealth within their business. Significant amounts are going to move from one generation to the next. And to date, we've all focused on the millennials inheriting that wealth. But what we're seeing is that, about two-thirds of the baby boomer wealth is held in joint households. And therefore, often the first point of transfer is from, I am generalising, but it is from husband to wife. Now, what we're seeing is that, interestingly, 70% of women inheriting wealth will change advisors. But what we're also seeing is that there is a much more engaged younger generation coming through. But if you think about why these women are changing advisors and what some of the challenges are, is they felt shut out of conversations. They felt unable to ask basic financial literacy questions. They apparently are more risk averse. I actually like to think they're just more risk aware and maybe just take a bit longer to make decisions. But also they're very keen to have sustainable solutions. So there's a real opportunity here for advisors to deliver focused advice and investment solutions. We held a session last year in Schroders. I think we had about 160 young women along to that session to talk about savings and investment. And that wasn't women just in the financial services industry, it was across the piece. And I was amazed at the level of engagement that we had from these women, particularly because we gave them an environment in which to do that, in which to talk about, savings, investment, what it meant for them, and how they could benefit from just speaking to each other about it. So whilst I think we've still got a way to go, I think I'm seeing, real progress in this area.
I've got a couple of things to add on the psychological angle there as well, Gillian, that actually advisory businesses and the words that they use to talk to their clients are critically important. There've been numerous studies, actually, Prass, Sanders and Leonard, for example, as recently as 2018, talked about, can words breed or kill investment? And when they studied metaphors, imagery, investor behavior, changed very much, and it was very clear that many female clients were absolutely deterred by jargon. I think if businesses want to build sustainable, scalable futures for themselves commercially, but also to attract the sorts of clients that you're describing there, then they're going to have to revisit a lot of their literature and the way they articulate things so that those messages get through. And I think that will make a significant change into the future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Stu. I think it's not necessarily a different proposition that women need. It's just about being engaged differently and somebody understanding that they come from this potentially from a different perspective. And I think certainly we're seeing advisors really wake up to this situation that, you know, this first point of wealth transfer is often to a female who, as one advisor said to me the other day, they can be a bit rabbit in the headlights and they need somebody to guide them through the maze of investing. You know, I always hate to sort of generalise, but I think we have to. This doesn't obviously refer to every female, but certainly in that older generation, we are seeing a lot of women needing help and advice. So, you know, there is a great opportunity here for advisors to grab that and to think about the proposition they're delivering and how they engage.
So, Gillian, just one final question to you. What do you think needs to change for that change to happen?
Well, first of all, I think advisors need to, you know, I think we need to wake up to it. I think we're far too focused on, certainly from a wealth transfer perspective, we're far too focused on wealth moving to millennials as opposed to this first point. I think they need to understand, you know, a bit of an audit on the business. What position are they in terms of their clients? How engaged are they with both the husband and wife? And interesting, actually, what we're seeing, obviously, as a result of the last year, an increased use of technology. And many advisors are saying to me that they're actually finding it easier to engage with those wider families, and particularly with both partners, through the use of technology. So, you know, there's lots of, I think, almost small steps that can be put in place. But we've got to just be careful as well that this doesn't come across as patronising, if I could call it that. You know, women really want to be engaged with their finances. And, you know, let's make sure that we've got an inclusive industry here that helps them along the way.
Here's what else investors are talking about. Commodity prices are rising. A number of factors are supporting that. Such price rises could have a profound effect on the type of companies equity investors want to own. After years of being out of favour, suddenly commodity-related stocks, which are often found at the value end of the spectrum, may find themselves back in demand. You can read the full article, "Will Rising Commodity Prices Prompt a Shift for Equity Investors?" by Martin Scanberg, a European equities fund manager, at schroders.com/insights, where you can find out much, much more. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, you can go to schroders.com/the investor download. There you can listen to our back catalogue and read related articles. If you want to contact us about anything in the show, email us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. You can rate, review and subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.